Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy it. This story was first published on June 1st of 2023 under the headline, First Policewoman Was a Municipal Rescuer. It's part one of a two-part series on the life and legacy of Lola Green Baldwin. By the time Walt Disney Productions released The Rescuers in 1977, the idea of a rescue aid society dedicated to the eradication of kidnapping felt quaint and old-fashioned and fun. But not many years earlier, when memories of the progressive era were fresher, it would not have scanned that way. In fact, The Rescuers was first pitched in 1962, at which time Walt Disney himself killed it. And that was probably a good call. Members of the real aid societies were still alive and had matured into one of the fiercest and most serious cohorts of old ladies the world had ever known. A cartoon that seemed to poke fun at the great accomplishments of their younger lives, even gentle and good-natured fun, would have brought them out of retirement ready for battle. And Walt knew what they were capable of. He had been there in those aid society ladies' heyday. And he'd been working in show business, one of the industries they regularly locked horns with. No, The Rescuers would not come out in 1962. It would have to wait until every society lady who in her youth had made it her life's work to stamp out quote-unquote white slavery was gone, along with Disney himself, before it could be safely made. For that was what all the aid societies were about. They weren't dedicated to finding and rescuing little orphan kids who had been kidnapped by evil, flame-haired swamp witches to steal diamonds, no. They were anti-human trafficking organizations. And one of their most prominent and effective members was a Portland woman named Lola Green Baldwin, known to history as the first paid female police officer west of the Rockies. Lola Green was born in 1860 in Elmira, New York, and raised in Rochester. She grew up following a decidedly non-traditional education path that ended with her acquiring her competency Abraham Lincoln style as an autodidact by firelight at night after she was forced to drop out of school when her father died. After passing the relevant exam, Miss Green took a job as a schoolteacher in Lincoln, Nebraska, and it was there that she met and married her husband, LeGrand Baldwin. After the wedding, the custom at the time was for the former Miss Green to leave her schoolteacher job and settle into, quote-unquote, keeping Mr. Baldwin's home for him and bearing his children, end quote, full-time. She soon found, however, that these wifely duties didn't come to a full-time job for her. She also chafed at being cloistered away from the world. It was now the 1880s, and American society was still in the throes of a change in how it viewed a woman's place. The traditional pre-Civil War view was that the quote-unquote cult of true womanhood, according to which the proper role of a wife was kind of like a domestic chaplain and mascot. She was to stay in the home, having babies and setting a great example to the children, and focusing all her energies on helping her family stay clean, morally upstanding, and as sin-free as possible, letting her husband do all the work out in the world. But then had come the run-up to the Civil War and the great work of abolition, and women had done great things to end the social evil of slavery. After the war, many ladies decided they preferred to stay active and started looking for other charity work to occupy their energy. Of course, there was plenty of injustice in the world for a lady to work to fight. There were bright-eyed girls who fell in love with and married men who turned out to be secret drunkards. There were little orphans walled up in cold stone workhouses. And there were innocent country girls tempted into a, quote, life of shame by a visit to an opium den on a dare. So that's how the abolition movement led middle and upper-class women to start leaving their homes and working for change in the world. They did it with a Bible in one hand and their hearts in the other, leaning on each other for support. It all kicked off, more or less, 9 years after the war, with the temperance riots of 1874. When groups of ladies dressed up in their Sunday best and held prayer sessions in saloons and roadhouses, pleading with the drinkers there to give up demon rum and go home to their neglected families. And that activity, in turn, led some of the ladies to learn about the plight of the women and girls upon whom many of those saloons preyed. The typical 1880s saloon was not much like the comparatively wholesome taverns that folks would stop at for a beer on the way home from work a century later. Basically, they were one-stop sin shops. Here's how the model worked. The saloon keeper would rent a building from an agent. The agent was necessary because the owner of the building was usually a respectable member of society who did not want anyone to know that he made his money renting real estate to vice operators. The saloon keeper would set up his operation in the best part of the building, laying it out with card tables and faro rooms as needed. He would also set up some performance spaces for dancing girls. And then he would sublet some prime street front space to a grill restaurant, which would of course serve liquor from his saloon, and he would sublet the upstairs to a madam, who would stock it with girls and women. There would sort of be a promotion track for the girls. They would start out making pretty good money as dancers or as eye candy in the bar, enticing customers to come in and buy drinks. Sooner or later, most of them would be tempted by the easy money to turn a trick or two, and they would end up aging out of the brothel industry and being discarded like worn-out clothes to make room for the next crop of younger women. There were variations on this. Many saloon keepers who wouldn't host brothels for moral or ethical or other reasons. In Portland, Edward Chambreau reluctantly drew the line there because his wife wouldn't stand for it. Many others, like Erickson's famous saloon on Burnside with its dainty lunch, merged the grill into the saloon and offered free food as an enticement to customers to come in and drink. But that was the basic model. So obviously a big crowd of hymn-singing ladies there to save the drunks was in a great position to observe all of this, and maybe even to be approached by prostitutes wanting to leave the business or young girls who were being groomed to take their place in it. When Lola Green Baldwin got married and left her teaching job, these lady activists had just started doing something about this problem. They had started creating institutions or homes for, quote, wayward girls and fallen women, with an eye towards giving these erstwhile sex workers an off-ramp, or better yet, intercepting young at-risk teens and giving them some social support so they could more easily stay strong. In Lincoln, the new Mrs. Baldwin found several of these institutions to plug into, the Nebraska Rescue Home and the Home for the Friendless. Soon she was, as historian Gloria Myers puts it, interviewing inmates to determine the best course for their moral salvation. So right away, Ms. Baldwin was hearing the stories. Most likely there were some terrible ones. They obviously touched her heart. Over the next several decades, she would dedicate her life to doing something about them. Time went by. The Baldwins left Lincoln. Eventually, by 1904, they moved to Portland. LeGrand had taken a job for a chain of dime stores and was tasked with opening a store in Oregon. So Lola went forth and plugged into the Portland AIDS Society scene. She found an eager, active community waiting for her. The Florence Crittenden Rescue Home and the Portland YWCA Travelers Aid Society were delighted by her energy and compassion, and soon she was a vital part of their operations. And they needed the help. The Lewis and Clark Centennial Exposition, the first World's Fair on the West Coast, was just coming up in a year, and the ladies were very worried. At earlier exposition fairs back east, they had observed a disturbing pattern. Thousands of innocent country girls had come to see the electric lights and play at the carnival, and recruiters for the always-hungry sex industries had noticed and moved in. Worse, there were rumors of a vast and shadowy conspiracy, an underground quote-unquote white slave trade, organized and staffed by sinister swarthy foreigners that was allegedly kidnapping girls and spiriting them away to a life across the sea of miserable sex service and foreign seraglios and harems. These rumors turned out to be total bunk, but they played perfectly with the mainstream society's xenophobia and endemic racism. To a 40-year-old clubwoman in 1905, it made perfect sense that members of quote-unquote inferior races, like Greeks, Slavs, Arabs, Italians, etc., would look at quote-unquote racially superior Nordic women, close quote, as sexual trophies. So when Lola Baldwin came to Portland, the Travelers Aid Society quickly identified her as just the woman to run their operations at the fair to frustrate these sinister flesh traders and protect Oregon girls. Lola Baldwin was ready, willing, and more than able to take this on. In tomorrow's episode, we'll hear about how she did in her role as defender and protector of Portland's girls. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Say, are you an audiobook listener? And do you enjoy old pre-war pulp stories like Tarzan of the Apes and Conan the Barbarian and The Call of Cthulhu and stuff like that? Or do you like early Victorian penny dreadful fiction like Sweeney Todd and Varney the Vampire and Highwayman Dick Turpin? If so, you might enjoy the audiobooks I have out there in the world. The easiest way to find them is for the search for my name on audible.com. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.